traffic is sort of, I've started to regard it as like the weather. There's you can't do much about it, and it's sort of predictable. You sort of know what times of the day, but you never are sure because it can pop up anywhere, anytime. And it's an opportunity for practice. Traffic happens. My name is Tony Bernhardt, and I am a friend and student of Sylvia's. And I so enjoy getting a chance to come and visit with you guys, I guess occasionally. And in putting together some thoughts for sharing with you, there's been a line that's been going through my head for a week, and it's generated all kinds of associated thoughts. So I wanted to start with, it's just a line of John Lennon's, which is, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. And it's been particularly striking to me, aside from the fact that he, you know, puts in there, while you are busy making other plans, because basically other plans happen too. But what has been particularly striking for me is this notion that it happens. It just happens. I mean, basically this life, this consciousness, awareness that we're in the midst of, did any of us here pick this? You know, it just happened. There's a in current neuroscience, which is sort of where a lot of the cutting edge academic thinking is going on right now. It's a little metaphor that pops up occasionally, and the idea is, if you toss a rock into the air and then give it consciousness in the midst of its arc, it's going to take responsibility for what it's doing and make sense of what's going on, as if it were motivated, as if it were intentional. And we're sort of in the same spot. But really what's going on is that it's all happening to us. Even us is happening to us. Even you is happening to us. The thoughts of self, the thoughts of me and mine, they happen. There's a study that's been floating around. I first heard about it from Andy Olensky at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. A guy named Benjamin Lippitt, who is a neuroscientist at the University of San Francisco, did a little experiment. This is in the 80s, I guess. And in the experiment, he wired everybody up so that he could see what's going on, or that something was going on. I was amazed. I just became a grandfather again, and went to see my new granddaughter while in the hospital. And the nurses came by. This is a total aside, but they came by. She was less than a day old, and they wired up her head, and they put little ear muffs on, and they did a hearing test. What they did was they just did little clicks into the ears, and they measured whether there was any, you know, brain activity going on. They don't wait till they, you know, you whisper in there and see if they look around or anything. Nothing. I mean, they did that as a test. I was really surprised at that age or non-age. Benjamin Lippitt wired these people up, and he had them do a random motion of some kind, like punch a button or wave their hand or some punch a button. And what he discovered was that the intention to push the button arose almost a half second before the subject was consciously aware of making that decision. That the welling up of intention happened as part of a process, became aware almost after the fact, sort of like the rock tossed into the air, became aware. And this disturbs a lot of people because it suggests... Who's in charge here? Yeah, free will. Really at the heart of it. Or even free will at all. I mean, our impulses, our intentions, our desires happen to us. And we take responsibility for it. We say, I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm whatever. And I think some of this is just the result of linguistic convention, although it's not convention really. But, you know, when you say it's raining, what is this it? You know, it's cold, I'm cold. We add a subject into this. But things are happening, and they're happening to us. And then we struggle to try to patch some sense onto this experience of how it's us and it's ours and we're doing it and we're responsible. I think a lot of that is, you know, language, just the conventions of language, since since almost any sentence in addition to a verb has something that's verbing, you know? And so we sort of, you know, graft on a self. You know, us. The universe happens, life happens. Our intentions, our motivations, they happen to us. Life is what happens to us while we're busy making other plans. These other plans are part of these, this, you know, punch the button, you know. It is a result of the causes and conditions in the midst of which we find ourselves. In a way, this is all in accord with the Buddha's description of our experience broadly, or existence. Sometimes it's described as existence, not that I'm able to distinguish between the two. Impermanence. Everything is in motion. Everything is in motion. And because of that, there's nothing that you can point to that is capable of providing any real satisfaction. And the third of these qualities is, well, the word anatta, not self. There's no entity here, no agent anywhere. And I remember Sylvia saying, you know, the first time she heard the description of the three characteristics of existence or experience, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self, she thought, well, two out of three is not bad. Not that we like this stuff. Anybody here like the fact that we're impermanent? You know, even that we are just a moment's sunlight, you know, whatever. And you make it all kind of dreamy and wonderful, but, you know, this impermanence business, the only time we really like it is when we're in the midst of a bummer of some kind. and then we do the this too will pass. But when things are going great, we don't tend to reach for that one. You know. So, you know, impermanence is not really our favorite. And boy, do we, you know, the idea that there's nothing capable of providing any satisfaction. We don't even want to hear that. That's what we're practicing for some satisfaction. You know. And the last one is really interesting. It's translated often as not self, anatta, which is somewhat almost not literal, but pretty close translation of the word. But I've also heard it recently translated as impersonality. Now, it's just empty conditions rolling on. the phenomena of the world is just happening. Life is what happens to us. Life is what happens. This is just happening. You know? And if there's no self present, there's except the thought of self that arises within us and the emotional reaction that we have to ourselves, to this thought of self. And it's all unfolding according to the causes and conditions of this universal field that we're in, that we are part of. I was listening to Steve Armstrong talk about this recently, and I thought, boy, if there's no agent here, I said to him, so what you're suggesting is that the impulse to awaken is just an example of intelligent design. And without missing a beat, he said, yes, thank God. No. So, you know, this is this impersonal experience that is occurring, and we'd like to think to us, or to each other, we'll share it. This is where we find ourselves. Where is the potential for freedom? Because that's in this practice. That's what we talk about, right? I mean, that's we're doing something here, you know. Lippitt said that the only place for free will in this whole scheme was in the potential for not taking up that impulse that arises. You know? For not, you know, for just sitting and watching, for just observing, for being aware, for just being aware of what's arising and, of course, what's passing. So the potential here is completely in accord with the Dharma. You know, becoming aware of what's arising and passing. And to ground ourselves, we use our breath as a target for practice, for wetting our consciousness, for training it, our awareness. To just be aware of what's arising. And that's the freedom not to act out on the impulses that arise. And, you know, the impulses, I don't know whether this happens to you. You probably have examples of your own. But I know this from times when I get startled, you know, and when I think of that, I think of something coming at my face like a bug. And even before I can react, my hand waves it away. You know, or you just flinch. Something, and it's almost like when the doctor hits your knee and your knee flaps or your leg flaps. You know, it's reflex. It happens almost before you're aware of it. So all this stuff is just happening, and something is going on, and that something is the term that we use in our tradition is clinging. You know, and it's the one thing that's Joseph Goldstein says is the one thing that's common to all three of the traditions. He spent some time trying to work out how the Tibetan, the Zen, and the Theravadan traditions were manifestations of the same thing, and he came in his book One Dharma. He says basically, there's none of these traditions do the teachers say, cling. No, they don't say cling. So this clinging, you know, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to. We don't clinging is, we cling to the idea of not clinging. You know. Don't we?
Yeah.
You know? We do. We cling to all kinds of stuff. We cling to the Dharma. You know, I once sat in a meeting, a group, Dharma study group, and watched a bunch of people gang up on one poor woman who said she did have a self, and they were telling her she didn't. You know, you don't have a self. I do have a self. I don't. You know, and I thought, you know, we're looking so desperately to cling to something to stop this onrushing, impermanent experience, to create something satisfying. So what is this clinging like? We all do it, but it's subtle. It's hard to spot. It's the wanting. You know, the second noble truth is that the cause of our suffering, our discomfort, is our dissatisfaction, is wanting. Wanting things different. Wanting things different than they are. And that wanting is painful itself, just in itself. It can make us cry, you know, when we want things to be different, particularly when we're dealing with, you know, life and death issues and loss, issues of loss, and wanting things. What a surprise. Life is impermanent. You know, one of my friends likes to joke about the woman who died unexpectedly at age 92. you know. What we look around, what do we expect? But we just don't like impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and this not self business, whatever it means. You know. But the thought is that if we were totally, you know, with the way things were, just this is the way they are, they're not going to be great. The sickness that we have, the sadness. What else do we expect? That sadness is suffering because we expect it to be different. We want it to be different. And that is our suffering. That is the suffering that the Buddha is pointing to. That clinging, that sad, and we certainly don't want to feel that. And we'll do all kinds of things. We'll make it much worse trying to not have to feel that sadness. In some ways, it's sort of like scratching an itch, you know, like you get, or a mosquito bite. That's my favorite one. Because if you actually pay attention to the scratching, it's not pleasant. It's a counter-irritant, really. And you can actually wind up tearing your flesh to make that itch go away. Well, I can't. No. Becoming free from that clinging impulse, that impulse that to want things pleasant, want things different, and really we're wanting things more pleasant and less painful. Somewhere on that continuum, we want the valence to move in the direction of pleasant, right? I mean, sort of. To be free of that is you know, to experience it with awareness, clear awareness, just to experience it as it happens and see it clearly. Just feel deeply what we're doing when we're wanting. Tough to do, you know. As I used to practice Tai Chi, and my teacher used to do something very, he'd move his hand really slowly and he'd say, "Look so easy, but how do you do it?" That was the line he used all the time. "Oh, it's the move, it's really simple, but how do you do it?" Sounds so simple, to be free of clinging. But, you know, when you cling to wanting to be free, when you cling to clinging or being free from clinging, you know, it's the thought in our mind that we cling to. So how do we do that? Well, the answer is pretty visible. I mean, the Buddha's teaching was, you know, the Eightfold Path. And I mean, that's when I first started practicing, eight sounded way too big. Sounded way too many. Eight? My gosh, you know. And then I heard about the 12 links of dependent origination, and oh my gosh. They were in the 37 wings of awakening, and the these were lists beyond comprehension. I just wanted a simple, of course, the simple thing, which is don't cling, pay attention. You know, we're back in the realm of sounds so simple, but how do you do it? But the Eightfold Path is the Buddha's path, and it seems to me, I mean, that's his instructions. And so I'd like to go through the elements of the path, almost, you know, there's a couple of ways of doing this. One is to get up real close to one, and I, you know, you could spend hours talking about any one of them, and people do. We may have. I have. You probably have. Some of you, anyway. Or you can step back and try to take it all in and see what it's getting at generally. And I'd sort of like to do that, because what we want generally is relief from the dissatisfaction of our experience, with our experience. We want relief from it. And the way we go about trying to find relief is we try to get what we want. Whatever it is we want, we've got an idea of what will make that discomfort go away. I'm hungry, I'll have another muffin. Why did I think muffin? Well, because that's where I'm headed after after this. The idea of relief is getting what we want, and that will provide a little relief, but it won't, you know, momentary, because the next moment another desire will arise. But freedom from that suffering is different, and that's what the Eightfold Path is addressing. Now, it's usually there are eight elements, and for those of you who aren't intimately familiar with them, I'm going to rattle them off pretty quick. And they're usually described as right understanding, right intention, etc. I'm going to leave off the right part because I just want to identify the realms that they address. So it's understanding and intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and, well, concentration, I like the word stability more. And they're clumped in three, they're usually grouped in three groups. So the first two, understanding and intention, are grouped together. And then speech, action, and livelihood are grouped together. And effort, mindfulness, and stability or concentration are grouped together. And the groups are often described in many ways, but I think the first group is about understanding. It's about, you know, understanding and intention. It's the wisdom element. It's the knowing element. And then speech, action, and livelihood, these are about restraining our behavior. It's about sitting and watching, not taking up that impulse that's occurring before we're conscious of it. You know, the rock has been thrown into the air, us, and all of a sudden we're aware that we want something. And this is about restraining behavior, particularly in areas which are going to give us more turbulence in our lives, make things worse. Really, that's, in a way, that's what we're trying to do is to restrain the kinds of activities that we do that make things worse. You know, in some ways, that's a huge contribution to ourselves and to others, to just not make things worse. It can be a really helpful underpinning for our practice, just to not make things worse. I remember listening to an NPR program. It was probably Talk of the Nation a couple years ago, and it was coming up to the Christmas holiday season, and they had a panel of experts how to get along at the holiday dinner. And they all had advice, you know, and people were calling in and saying, well, what about when your mother-in-law says da 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 da, and what about when you're, you know, and nobody said, they all say, well, dodge this and, you know, deflect that, and but nobody said, just don't you be the asshole at the table. Don't you be the one making it worse. It's just, it's always out there. It's nobody. So these areas about speech, action, and livelihood, which are considered the sila, the areas of moral restraint, they're the practices where we don't take up the impulse, the want, the cling that would impel us to push the button or, you know, make things worse. And the last is cultivating our ability to see more clearly, to see things as they are, to not be deluded by the thoughts we have about things. Christopher Titmus likes to say, everything you think is wrong. And, you know, he does like to get a rise out of everybody. But he's getting at something, which is that the thoughts that we have about the world and our life are not, I mean, what we barely even know what's going on in the universe. I hang out on the NASA website because it's real handy, because they have these little video clips. You don't have to read anything. You just click the button and somebody talks to you and says, did you know black holes, da 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 da. Things sort of sit there I am really lazy. So what I've learned, you guys know about dark matter? I mean, most of the universe, it turns out, is dark matter, whatever that is. We don't know what it is, but we know it's there. Really, 80%, they say on the NASA site, or this voice says, on the NASA site, says 80%. What, we don't even have language for that. We don't even have a clue. And yet we'll think, well, we know what's going on in the world, da-da-da-da, global warming, or, you know, whatever. What? You know, And what do? We cling to our ideas, the thoughts we have. You know, so what we're trying to do with effort, mindfulness and concentration or stability, it takes effort to do this. It takes effort to be able to see things as they are, because we're distracted by our thoughts of how things are. Don't we believe, you know, we think we've got an idea about what's going on. Okay, maybe we're more or less wrong, but we got some, we're less wrong. I mean, there's something there, right? Those ideas, those thoughts. The Buddha's shortest Dharma talk that I know that he gave is one of my favorites, but he was, he arrived in town and one of the, you know, at the time there were a lot of forest-dwelling samanas, the people who'd gone forth for the purpose of achieving some kind of spiritual awakening. And there was this guy, Bahia, who heard the Buddha was in town. He thought, oh, you know, I've been working at this for a while, and here comes you know, the Samana Gautama. And so he tracks him down and he comes up to him and he says, I've been working at this for a while. Can you help me out? And the Buddha says, well, I'm on alms rounds. Why don't you come back after lunch? And he says, you know, I know enough about the Dharma to know there may be no after lunch. So, you know, maybe you could help me out now. So the Buddha said, okay. And the talk that he gave was, in the seeing, only the seeing, in the hearing, only the hearing, in the touching, the tasting, and in the thinking, or in the cognizing, only the thinking. Seeing the thoughts, the knowing, as knowing, regardless of the content, not being distracted by the content, just to see it as it arises. This is the response to Lipitz. You know, the impulse arises before we're conscious of it. We become aware of it, we see it as it is. We don't get distracted by it. And so we can see the impermanence of all things because there isn't, you know, two successive moments. I hate the thought of successive moments because that's a conceptual notion that there's a moment and then there's another moment. Try this. Imagine spatially the past, the present, and the future. And let me just ask, where is the past located? Is it behind you? Now, there are two different ways of doing it. And some people, so for a lot of people, the past is behind, the present is here, and the future is ahead. For some people, the past is to the left, the future is here, or the present is here, and the future is right. How many people left to right? How many people back to front? Yeah. And then some of us are just adrift, totally. Past? You guys are in good shape. So I hate the notion of successive moments because basically all we've got is the present. This is just the present moment. And this is the same moment that the Buddha lived. Things have changed a bit, but it's the same present moment. And the rest, the concept of, well, that's 2,500 years ago, those are thoughts. Those are just thoughts. And if we can maintain stability of mindfulness to just see those thoughts arising and passing, see them just as thoughts, then the wisdom, it feeds back on the wisdom. The wisdom, our ability to see and understand deepens. And then with that, so we can sort of trip right through the eight paths as our understanding deepens, as we see more clearly, our intention will change. Our intention towards ourselves, others, the world. It's not a mistake that the Buddha put intention after understanding. Because our intentions follow from our understanding. If we think that, you know, if we have an understanding that if we're late to work one more time, we're going to be fired, we're going to act in response to that. Whatever understanding we have, if our understanding is that, you know, our current military excursions are causing pain and suffering and we don't like that, our intention will be to try to do something to end that. Or whatever our intention is. If we think that somebody is going to try to cut in on us and we're in traffic and we've just had enough of that, you know, our intention is going to flow from that. Intention flows from our understanding, which is why it's so important that we not be attached to our delusions. Because if we act on the basis of delusion, if we act on the basis of misunderstanding of how things are, then we are going to make things worse for ourselves and for others. So, right intention, right understanding, the Pali word, Pali, as the language that the Buddha spoke, Pali word is sama, and it's interpreted most frequently as right. On the little wheel up the hill, it's skillful, wise, right, wise understanding. But basically, it's understanding and intention that do not add to suffering, because it's the fourth part of the Four Noble Truths. And the purpose of this path is, this is the way to the end of suffering, to freedom from that clinging. And so understanding things, not being deluded, is really at the heart. It's the first of the elements, this understanding. You know. And delusion is tricky, because any of us think we're deluded? Good job, yeah. How do you know that's if there's even an inkling that you're not, if you're even entertaining the question, And particularly the delusions are that it's, you know, that okay, maybe things aren't permanent, but they're permanent for practical purposes. You know, for all practical purposes, there's some stability, and that it's possible to satisfy ourselves by getting what we want. Aren't we still, isn't that what we're still doing? Trying to get what we want? Even if what we want is liberation and freedom and peace in the world, and we're trying to get that. And how are we doing? You know? And that it's all about me. You know? That's, you know, almost everything that occurs in the world, we relate to ourselves. So there, you know, And clinging, when it comes to our ideas about the way things are, clinging is about belief. So we believe it. We believe something. We believe the sky is blue. Well, of course it's blue, right? You know the Zen thing, what is this? You call it a pen, I'll smack you 30 times. You say it's not a pen, I'll smack you 30 times. What is it? It's an effort to try to not deal with our, to think through the thinking, the clinging to the thoughts, you know, which, you know, as thoughts, they're just thoughts. But you know, their attempts to map our experience, to map our world. The first law of, semantics is the map is not the territory. You know, the word your mother is not your mother, right? It's just not. Pen? Well, that's just a concept that we apply to it. You know, somebody who's never seen a pen, my new granddaughter doesn't look at this and see pen. I'm not sure what you... what she sees, but you know, it's the believing, and so that first element, right view, it's not just knowing the right thing. It's not just okay, I got it. Impermanence, check. Unsatisfactory, check. Not self, got it. Okay, now I'm cool. It's not just the Buddha tells simile of the raft. You guys know the simile of the raft? He says, you know, so you're it's actually a longer thing. There's lots of words in there. He says, a guy comes along and he comes to a river and he can't get across the river and he wants to get to the other side. And so he he gathers up sticks and grass and logs, and he ties them all together, and he uses them paddling with his arms and his legs. He gets in effort. Right? He paddles across to the other side. When he gets to the other side, he says, "This raft has just been great for me. I think I'll carry it around." So it's the same with the Dharma. Even the teachings are to be held lightly, not clung to. They're used. You know, in Zen they say Zen is a finger pointing at the moon. But if you mistake the finger for the moon, what help is there? And so the teachings are pointing at that freedom. They're pointing at the end of suffering. But if we cling to them, not going to work. And we shouldn't cling to anything, nothing. And if we don't, then what kind of an intention will arise? An intention for what? There may be a response to a suffering being that we encounter, and that will arise within us. What will arise is compassion, because we'll see the suffering. If we aren't seeing the suffering in every other person we encounter, it's because we're thinking of ourselves. You know, how is this for me? What's up for me? Because the first noble truth is that suffering and unsatisfactoriness, that's all of us. Each of us. We're all in that boat. There's none of us, I don't think. Anybody here, it's going the way you planned? You know? The way you'd script it out? Yeah. We're all in that same boat. So that understanding and the intention, what intention? John Cage, a composer from the last century, used to say, maybe he even wrote a book titled, "How to Improve the World, You'll Only Make Matters Worse." So understanding that is a huge part of the practice. And the restraint of our behavior that will make things worse, those are the elements of speech, skillful speech, wise speech, right action and right livelihood. And oh my gosh, we generally know these as the precepts, are part of our practice, and we take the precepts in this class formally. Once a month we get together and reaffirm them and revisit them and just make sure that we're remembering, because remembering is the toughest part. Joseph Goldstein says, being mindful isn't hard, but remembering to be mindful is hard. You know, even when you sit with your eyes closed, you know how hard it is to remember to stay with your breath? Oops, missed the breath again. And so, the precept practice is at the heart, and livelihood is left off. We sort of don't know where to go with livelihood, because we often equate that with our job, what we do, and is right. And if we're not making weapons or dealing in poison or trading in living beings. Isn't that what those were the things that the Buddha said? Was poison, don't deal in poisons, weapons, trading in living beings. I think there may have been another one. Then we say we're okay. But what if you're managing a Safeway? There's certainly poisons in there, and if you got, lobsters in the or oysters in the fish department, you got living beings and what was the other one? Weapons? I suppose there's enough chemistry in there to make anything you want explode. Livelihood we sort of write off. But livelihood is much deeper. It's about not just what we do, because in this society, it's much more complex than it was for the Buddha. You know, almost anything we do, winds up, we get paid in money, and that's an abstraction that we then use to construct a life and a lifestyle. And so it's about both. It's about the lifestyle we construct, not just about the way we support ourselves. You know, the restraint from acting out greed, aversion, and delusion. That's what these three elements are about. They're more, it's described, they're characterized as moral restraint. But it's just restraining that impulse that arises, that Lippitt was saying, that impulse to push the button, just to watch that impulse arise, and then just before you go and punch the button, you say, ah, desire, wanting, punch the button. And the freedom is there. And the bliss of, you know, when you try to punch the button, usually what we're doing is something more complex than punching the button, and it usually doesn't wind up with the button being punched. And the last elements, effort, mindfulness, and stability. Well, you know, effort is, you can't, and these things are all tied together, because you can't really practice moral restraint without effort, because the usual impulse, you know, going with the current of what is arising. You know, the rock's been thrown in the air. The impulse arises before we're aware of it. Going with the flow is just what we've been doing all along. So it takes effort. You know, it's not just, it takes effort to maintain mindfulness. We know that. We sit and we close our eyes and we aim at our breath with our attention, and the next thing we know, we're noticing that we haven't been, you know, watching the breath. Or in the seeing, only the seeing, in the hearing, the tasting, the touching, you know, in the thinking. We maintain that kind of attention towards all that arises, just what's arising. And the ability to maintain that mindfulness in the midst of this onrushing experience, that's the stability, that's the concentration that the Buddha is pointing at. And without mindfulness, the precept practice is going to be tough, because you're just not even going to notice until we're already halfway down the path. Taking what is not freely given. Now, that doesn't just apply to, you know, somebody's lunch. It applies to their time, their attention, their consent, all kinds of things. And the more we are able to maintain that, it takes effort to maintain that mindfulness, effort to maintain the stability of mindfulness that lets us see more deeply, that feeds back into our understanding that things are just as they are, and that how to change the world will only make things worse. And so we restrain our activity in an effort not to make things worse. So the Eightfold Path is the path. That's what else to pay attention to, what else to work with. The Eightfold Path is the path for freedom from suffering, not just the relief of the discomfort that comes with a desire. Because when we're just looking for relief, people do all kinds of crazy things. We've all got addictions of one kind or another, you know, habits of one kind or another, you know, that try to lighten things for a moment. But the Buddha's path is the path of freedom. Freedom from the clinging, from the discomfort that comes from wanting things to be different from the way they are. Doesn't mean that we're not going to enjoy pleasant when it arises. But we're not going to make it worse by trying to make it last longer than it's going to last. And we're not going to make the unpleasant worse by anguishing over how it's shown up. Life is what happens to us when we're busy making other plans. The other plans happen to us too. We happen to us. All of it happens to us. It's all empty phenomena rolling on. Sometimes it's amazing what the Buddha saw. I think there are a lot of people, there are people who have very deep awakenings. It's a great book by a woman named Jan Fraser. I've seen a picture of her. She looks just like any of us. And she had a moment of awakening in which she came to the end of suffering. Wow, looks like she's in her 20s. The book may be out there. It's called When Fear Falls Away. She'd been practicing for a long time and then had a moment where she had to go for a mammogram, and it was not a promising moment for her. And she thought, maybe, is there a way I could do this without being afraid? And apparently that was it. And the book is very interesting. But she doesn't have a practice like the Buddha provided us with a path. So sometimes we forget the path in the midst of all the other things that we're thinking about and clinging to and wishing for. So I just wanted to bring us back to that, because that really is his teaching, those elements, and encourage us to work with them. So let me just take a moment, the last few moments that we've got here, and see what you think of all that. See what kind of questions happen. Please.
I'm bewildered by the concept of non-self.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to know who resists the impulse to push the button? Who chooses right speech?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're loading it up, because you're asking for a who. So I would have to say there is no who. But what happens is that when there's a certain, when you, and some of this is linguistic, our language really tricks us. So let's just regard this as conventional. But when you become aware that of what Lippitt found, for example, we do have there is an opportunity, because of our understanding, to not take up an angry impulse. Ah, there's anger. Look at that. Tight in my chest and my jaw. Boy, anger. We can just see it as it is. Who? I guess the Zen people would say, look into yourself and see. See who. In the Hindu tradition, that becomes a major meditative task. Who wants to know? Show me this self. And there's all the little tricks to try to get you. So there's bewilderment, because our mind map has us at the center of the world. It's all about me. Global warming? Oh, do I have to move to Canada? Do I have to put in air conditioning? What's it going to mean for me? We all interpret the world in terms of ourselves. So there's a lot of habit there. But if we just watch those things arise and pass, is there any stable thing there? It's as Sylvia said, 2 out of 3 is not bad. it's the one that really befuddles us the most. And I've come to start thinking of it in terms of impersonality. Everything, nothing you can point to is personal. And boy, that sure seems to be true. The thoughts about myself, they arise and they pass. You know, there's still a lot of habit. A lot of habit. But I recognize it as habit. Is that helpful at all?
To tell you the truth, when I ask the question, who resists the impulse, and you answer it using the words me and I and you, no.
Yeah? Well, the idea is not to answer it with a word, not use a concept. Try to find what that concept refers to. Mother is not your mother. The word mother is not your mother. The word me is not who you are. You are not the word me. So what is that word referring to? So try to find that in your experience.
Yeah. I think that last week Donald said something along the lines of, it's not all self, but it's not also all not no self, that there's some way that either extreme doesn't quite get at it. So I'm just thinking about that as you're talking about there is no self, but then there's obviously some consciousness.
The Buddha never said there is no self, actually. He never came out and said no self. What he said was that there's nothing you can point to. There's nothing in experience. So if there is something, it's not anything you can point to. It's dark matter, right. Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah. Anything else? Please.
Lately I've been thinking about, and I've been thinking, so I'm alone in this whole thing, but my experience of not self is different lately, and it has to do with not self freeing me, whatever. Self means the opportunity for everything.
That's certainly opening. Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that I don't have a self. It means that everything is myself.
That's...
So I've sort of got away from the semantics, which was disturbing me about not self.
Uh-huh. Does everybody hear what she's saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you see when you aren't preoccupied with your own, with what's arising. When that's not the focus of your attention, and then you see, that's, yeah. And that feels freer. It feels freer. Yeah. Please.
I was just so thrilled. And we just had to sit here, for me at least, not knowing where you were, how you were, how I was, what was going to happen. And it seemed like just the most beautiful segue to what you're talking about.
Well, you're welcome for my... If I knew known that, I would have changed my attitude. towards this truck. So thank you guys for your attention.